Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning to you, everybody. I want to welcome you all to a great episode we have here at Suspense Radio. Huge show coming up, our biggest show we've had to date. Nothing better way to kick off the July 4th weekend than to have these three authors on. First, we're going to have Boyd Morrison. His book, The Vault, comes out Tuesday, and it is the follow-up sequel with his characters from the arc that he had. Then we have John Gilstrap coming on to talk about his latest book, Threat Warning. And then we're going to cap it off from this hour-and-a-half-long show with Marcia Clark. Yes, she is the former district attorney in the O.J. Simpson case, and we're going to talk to her about her latest book, which is her first fiction book called Guilt by Association. So sit back, relax, you got a long way to go, and you got right now about 1 minute for Suspense Radio, so hit the bathroom. We'll see you in a second. Here we go. So I want to welcome everybody again this great Saturday morning. We have a huge show with you. We're going to have Boyd Morrison on in about 30 seconds. And so I want to remind everybody that our July magazine is out. You can get 4 free issues. You can order the magazine. Just go to suspensemagazine.com. All the information that you want to know is there, and you can find that out. But like I said, our first guest here, and I want to welcome him to the show, is Boyd Morrison. He is the author right now of his book coming out Tuesday, The Vault. It's a follow-up to his book, The Ark, which continues with the same characters, Tyler and Stacy. And so I want to go ahead and say, Boyd, thanks so much for joining us today, and how are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me on.
Right. So we were talking a little off-air, and you know, we were saying that The Vault comes out on Tuesday, and you're starting to gear yourself up for a quite extensive book tour you got going on. You're going to be leaving and going to Thriller Fest. So how, you know, explain a little bit about The Vault and kind of the follow-up to The Ark with your characters Tyler Locke and Stacy Benedict.
Well, Tyler Locke is a former Army combat engineer who's now working in the private sector, and he is on a Washington State ferry coming from Seattle when he gets a phone call that there is a bomb on board the ferry. And he is tasked with trying to disarm it in 20 minutes or it will explode and sink the ferry. And when he gets there, he finds that he is paired up with a classical languages expert named Stacy Benedict, who has gotten a similar phone call. And as they are disarming the bomb, they find out that this is just a test. And they've been tasked by a ruthless criminal to find something that would seem impossible, and that's finding the lost treasure of King Midas. And their search will require them to save their family members from a terrible fate so that they find the treasure or they will be killed. So Tyler is the protagonist from The Ark. Stacy is a new character, but Tyler is also helped by his friend Grant Westfield, who he met in the Army and now works with his company.
Well, Tyler's lucky because now he's gotten, you know, to be with two great women now in two different books. He keeps moving forward, so you gotta love that.
Well, yeah, Delara was the character from the Ark, and she's busy with Noah's Ark, so she couldn't join him in this adventure. But, you know, I've gotten a lot of people who've said they'd like to see her again sometime. So, you know, if the series goes on long enough, she may make a reappearance at some point.
Well, hopefully you have no plans to stop because you've been doing such excellent work here. And historical fiction, I've always mentioned, is what I feel the one of the hardest genres to write because you have so many different facts that could be true, could not be true. And so many things that you have to work your way around and weave your story in together. And so you went with Noah's Ark in the first one, and then this one, you're going after the King Midas factor. So how much research and things did it take you to put this one together as compared to, you know, maybe the last one, the Ark?
Well, they all take a lot of research because I want to get the facts as true as I can and then twist them a little and put a new spin on them. So in the Ark, I took on a biblical legend, and in the Vault, I'm turning my eye on Greek mythology. And part of the fun of the novels is that there's nothing supernatural in them. This is based in the real world, but maybe extending what we know about science and how that might explain these legends that have been mysteries for thousands of years.
And so what made you turn on, and the thing is that when you're looking at history, there's so many, you know, wonderful historical, you know, things that happened over time that you can go back and look at. What made you to go ahead and decide, King Midas? Did you have some kind of, you know, background with that or something that you had studied and you just decided that you wanted to go a little bit further in this? What's kind of the background of the King Midas, why you picked that one?
Well, first of all, I think it's an interesting fable on the problems with greed and what that can do, and so it's kind of a good life lesson and also a great theme to explore in the book. And as I was coming up with the idea for the follow up to the Ark, I was looking at tales from our history that seem fantastical and thinking about how I could maybe explain them in a scientific way. And also, as I was coming up with the story, I was able to start spinning in a link to Archimedes, who is, to me, a fascinating character from history. He's the one who created the Archimedes Death Ray that has been explored on MythBusters many times, but he's almost a mythical figure himself. But he really existed, and some people think Midas existed, and we just don't know the full story of what he did in ancient Phrygia, which is now Turkey. And then the third ancient mystery that has really intrigued me and I tied into the story was about the Antikythera mechanism, which is an ancient computer that was found 100 years ago in a shipwreck. And for many years, they kind of ignored it. And then when archaeologists started studying it, they realized it was more advanced than any mechanical device produced for another 1,500 years. And nobody has really discerned exactly what it was for. And so I came up with my own theory about what it was really, really intended to do. And so I, with those three really intriguing mysteries, I kind of then created the story around those to try to explain how they might all be tied together. And that's the fun of these stories is that, you know, you can create your own history or at least your own explanation for history.
Right, and you can be a little more expansive. You can, you know, use your mind in a fiction sense to, you know, it was just like this, it was like the movie's National Treasure, you know, with the Templar treasures. Now, whether it is there's one out there, but they went ahead and they put a great story together and making you believe that it could be at the bottom of this, you know, church in New York City, and these little clues and put together, and whether or not any of that is true, it still sounds good, and it makes a very compelling argument that it could be true. And what you've done is now you know, with your book, The Vault, people now go back and they start looking at these history things like King Midas's gold, and, you know, they start trying to relive, you know, these aspects of them, which is, you know, which is very different, you know, which is very fun for people to do because they might, you know, not have thought of that.
Yeah, and the fun thing about doing the research is discovering little details that I hadn't known. For example, Tyler's company in the story is named Gordian Engineering, after the Gordian knot, which is about solving the unsolvable problem with an elegant solution. And of course, the myth is that this incredibly complicated knot called the Gordian knot was created, and whoever could untie this knot would rule the world. And of course, Alexander the Great came along, and his solution was to cut the knot in two. And what I found out in the research was that Gordias was the son of King Midas. King Midas was the son of Gordias, and King Midas created the knot, the Gordian knot, in honor of his father. And
yeah,
I didn't know that until I started researching. And so it was nice serendipity. It ties in perfectly with Tyler's company and the theme of the books, which is that he's an engineer, so he's using those skills to solve these seemingly unsolvable problems.
And I'll remind everybody, we're talking to Boyd Morrison here, best-selling author of The Ark. His book, The Vault, comes out on Tuesday to places everywhere where you can buy books. And he's with the same characters that he had back, or the same character, Tyler, that he had back in The Ark here on Suspense Radio. So now, you kind of started your writing career a little different path than a lot of other authors, where The Ark, and then you have a couple other ones. You have Rogue Wave and you have The Catalyst. And those books were kind of out there as, you know, self-published books, and then all of a sudden you started selling a ton, and you got picked up by Simon & Schuster, and they put The Ark back out, and now you got The Vault. So how crazy now has it been, and I kind of asked this off the air, and I said we want to get into it, is, for the past year now, you've been a traditional published author and having to do all of those different things now that traditional publishers do that you weren't really maybe accustomed to. So now you got that year under your belt, and knowing how The Ark works and how the things work, to make it that much now more easier for, you know, for The Vault and going forward.
Well, it's easier and it's more challenging. It's great to have a lot of people working to make the books a success. So I have editors and marketers and publicists and the book packagers and the copy editors. And so that's nice, really nice to have that support group. But also there's a lot more pressure to have these come out, because when I was self-publishing, I would just write the book until I was done and then decide to put them out as an ebook. And now I have, you know, pretty strict deadlines, and not only that, but I have publishers in many different countries waiting for the book so they can start translating it. And so, you know, I can't lollygag around and just, you know, decide I'll just blow it off and it'll be done in another 2 months. No, the people need it. And so that's a bigger challenge than I was used to before, but it also helps me get the book done as well. So, you know I have to get it finished and move on to the next one. And the nice thing is I get emails from readers saying, write faster. I want more books.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that a lot of people have to realize from self-publisher to traditional, you had more of an opportunity to get books out faster because you didn't have to wait and put yourself behind the line in what Simon & Schuster was doing and everything else. And now people have to wait a year. I mean, that's just the way it goes. You write a book, you wait a year. The fans have to wait for them to get their book out there. And so, yeah, you're starting to get all those emails like, what's going on? When's the next one coming out? When's the next one coming out? And it makes it fun.
Yeah, yeah, and it's nice to get that encouragement. And for the people who read the first three books when they were e-books in 2009, The Vault is the first new book for them in 2 years. And
right.
So it's nice to get on that schedule, and then the Catalyst will come out in November, and then the next Tyler Locke book will be next year. So now I will be on a pretty regular publishing schedule. But until now, it's been kind of a wait for the people who read me early.
Now, and speaking of encouragement, the one thing that, you know, we hear from a lot of authors and people that are writing, they, especially new, they do not take criticism very well. They don't take bad reviews well, no matter, you know, whether or not it's a true review or maybe someone just trying to throw some revenge at them because they're jealous of them or whatnot. When you kind of put your books out there on Amazon and someone might have wrote something negative about the ARC or Rogue Wave or the Catalyst, you know, how did you handle that early on? I mean, what would you do?
I would probably stew for a little while and I think like most people, it's hard to take criticism. But when I was editing my books amongst my friends and family who are very smart, what I told them was be honest with me and tell me what doesn't work. Because when I send this out into the world with agents or publishers or consumers, they're going to give it to me straight, or they're just going to say, no thanks, or I didn't like it. And so they're not going to sugarcoat it. So please don't sugarcoat it with me when you're editing. But what I try to remember now is that I'm writing for the people who do like my books. You can't please everybody. And
right.
There are books that I don't like that other people love. And, you know, that's just the way it goes. And so I guess I've become a little more sanguine about it that, you know, there are just people who don't like the type of books I write, and that's fine. And, you know, luckily the reviews so far for The Vault have been great, and I've been very happy and pleased about that. But I know at some point that, you know, some people are not going to like it, and that's just the way it goes. And I think being rejected all of those years has kind of hardened me a little to that. And made me realize that, you know, it's just part of the business. And I try not to dwell on it. And I try not to read those reviews because it doesn't really do anything for me. Most people who write them, I can either tell that they don't read my type of book normally or the feedback they give me, I know are things that are challenges for me as a writer. And so, you know, I'm writing the best book I can, and I like the books, and you know, the people who count, my friends and family and my publisher and my agent, like my books. So, you know, I just have to write what I like to read and hope that readers out there agree with me.
And speaking of challenges and pressure, when you put the ARC out there, again, you had self-published it, you put it out there on your own, and, you know, you really didn't have, I guess, a lot of pressure per se as now, from when the ARC got picked up by Simon & Schuster, and now you have to write The Vault because of your success. What kind of pressure did you feel writing The Vault saying, God, don't screw this up? Because this is like the first
yeah.
book that you're actually writing for the publisher itself, because the first one they just got when it was already finished. How often, and how many nights when you were typing, you said, boy, don't screw this up, man, don't screw this
oh,
up.
Oh, I had many, many late-night conversations with my wife that, oh, this book isn't working, and I don't know if this is going to, you know, be something they like, and I hope I can,
like, just give them
I hope they're
going to
want more after this.
Anymore.
Yeah. When I talk to other authors, even though this is the fourth book I wrote,
right.
It seemed like a sophomore book. And when after talking to a number of writers, what I found out is it's not the second book that's hard to write. It's the first book under contract that's hard to write. Because, again, you have all these pressures that you never had before when you were just writing on your own and hoping somebody would read it someday. Now people are waiting for it. They want it, and they want it to be good. And they've already, you know, paid you in advance. And so they want their money's worth. And same for the readers. You know, the readers' expectations have been set now. And so you want to go out and hit a home run every time. And so that's, you know, a lot of pressure because, if it's not, then, you know, can you keep writing? But, you know, I think
it's a huge lifestyle change. You had to change your whole life around, because before you could write whenever you wanted to. Now you have to write because they're telling you have to have it done by, you know, let's just, you know, like by December 1st. You never had those,
right.
You know, those constraints against you.
Right, and it's a job. I mean, if it's not done, I don't get paid. So, you know, I could say, well, it's going to be delayed a year, and they'll say, well, fine, we're not going to pay you any more money. But,
right.
you know, so one thing you have to do is kind of treat it as a job. You know, you get up and you go to work and you put the time in, and there are deadlines, and when you're reaching a deadline, you have to be – I mean, when I was reaching deadlines on the vault, I was, you know, working all night sometimes, doing editing and writing the last few chapters. And it's a lot of pressure. But now that it's done and I know I can do it under deadline, it's still – pressure on the next book, because again I've been contracted for the next Tyler Locke book, and but I know I can do it, and I'm writing the next one, and I'm already coming up to the same things I came up to with the vault of, oh, this plot isn't working, and I don't know how these characters are going to fit together, and it's the fun part of it and it's the challenging part of it.
And again, I remind everybody, we're speaking here with Boyd Morrison. His website is boydmorrison.com. He's the best-selling author of The Ark, and his book, The Vault, comes out on Tuesday. Everybody can pick that up wherever books are sold. So, you know, we kind of talked about, we kind of mentioned a little bit, you know, like your challenges, and like you said, that your whole lifestyle had to change. And now that you're writing the next book, you've kind of at least been through those same situations, to where you know now how to push yourself through those walls to get through, you know, those stumbling blocks that you might have as far as writing goes. And so can you give everybody like a little bit about maybe what you're going to be doing here for the next one? I know The Vault has even come out, but everybody always likes to know what they're going to be looking forward to. So can you guys give a little bit of snippet about what's going on?
What I can say is that he is going to be investigating another historical and archaeological mystery that everybody has heard of. You know, one thing that I tried to do with both The Ark and The Vault is to address a mystery that as soon as you said it, everybody knows what you're talking about. So King Midas, everybody knows immediately when you say Midas touch what that is. And same with Noah's Ark. You, around the world, you say Noah's Ark to people and they know what that is. And so I will be doing that again with the next book, but I can't say more about it right now, because one thing that I don't want to set expectations in the story that may change as I'm writing it.
Right.
I've even had that come up with my editor, because, you know, you send them a synopsis of what you think the book is going to be. But then as you get into the writing, you come up with better ideas, or something in the synopsis just isn't working, so you have to change that. And so, you know, I can surprise even my editor when she gets the final book and it's not matching up with what I sent her before, but hopefully it's better. And that happened with The Vault. I changed quite a bit in the writing, and both my U.S. and U.K. editors liked the outcome even better than what I'd come up with in the synopsis. And then, again, that's what's fun about writing it is that discovery and serendipity as you're going, and you come up with, you know, that's the daily hit of the drug that you get every day when you come up with some brilliant idea.
Now, a lot of people, like, they might not know, and if they go to your website, boardmorrison.com, we're going to see that you wrote two standalones, Rogue Wave and The Catalyst. Which one of those two books would you like to go back and revisit and maybe write a sequel when you decide to go ahead and, you know, take a break from writing maybe a Tyler Locke series or another Tyler Locke book? Oh, did we lose Boyd?
Here.
Oh. Well, boys, you know, okay.
I think we got cut off for a second there.
I lost it for a second. Okay, so did you hear
I don't know where you lost me, but...
Okay, well, did you hear my question was, which book, people go to your website, BoydMorrison.com, you have Rogue Wave and you have The Catalyst, two books that people might not have known that you wrote, seeing as how, you know, the Ark has your character and The Vault has your same character, Tyler Locke. Which one would you like to go back and revisit maybe write a sequel to The Catalyst or Rogue Wave?
That's hard because in some ways the main character in Rogue Wave, Kai Tanaka, went through so much in that book. I kind of feel bad about doing more to him in another one. It was a pretty traumatic experience for him, but you know, I really like his character. And in The Catalyst, I think there's more open ground there because he's a graduate student, he's a young guy, and he's been through this kind of extraordinary adventure, and so he might have some more open ground to work with. He's almost like I kind of think of it almost like a younger version of Tyler Locke.
Okay.
In that he's not as accomplished as Tyler, and he's not as larger than life as Tyler is. He's just kind of this grad student who gets, it's more Hitchcockian in that he gets swept up into this conspiracy, and he's just this ordinary guy, whereas Tyler, you know, is a former combat engineer, and he has a lot of these skills which would make him more likely to be in these adventures. So I think either one would be fun to revisit, but given that, the Tyler Locke series is the one that seems to be connecting not only here, but in other countries. I mean, the Ark, I think, is published in 21 languages. So, you know, that's the one that's in demand right now. And unfortunately, because those books are so complicated to research, as we talked about, they take a lot of time to do. And you know, the other thing is I have a lot of other ideas for standalone stories. So, you know, I don't know if I would write sequels to those. And if I had a chance to write something besides a Tyler Locke story, I might do something new just to kind of flex my writing muscles.
Well, you know, I always like to add a little sports question. I don't know if you're a big sports fan, but I have to kind of know.
Huge football fan.
Okay, well, then it's not football, but you're the first person to talk to from Seattle, so I always like to know, how does it feel to Seattle people to see how good the Oklahoma City Thunder is doing? And for those who might not know, they used to be the Seattle Supersonics, and then you moved over to Oklahoma City. Does it sting? Does it hurt? Do you root for them? Do you, like, I don't like them, forget them, they're not in my city anymore? How does it feel on that front?
I'm not a big basketball fan, but as just from seeing what people have talked about, I think it's more they've just kind of forgotten about it and moved on to the Seahawks and the Mariners. Actually, the local Sounders soccer team has gotten a lot of interest from people. So maybe that's taken up the slack from the Supersonics. And the soccer team is, I think, selling out every single game here. And they have parades before each game. And so maybe people have just moved on to a different sport. I don't know. But, I don't think it's as devastating as, say, you know, the Cleveland Browns leaving for Baltimore. Because there was such history there.
And Seattle's one of those cities I'd love to go up and see a game in, because it's just fun to look at Quest Field and see how gorgeous it is and just see how crazy you guys get for your team that goes 7-9 and still wins the division and wins that playoff game.
Oh, it is super loud.
Yeah, I mean, that was great. So let's hope the lockout ends early. I'll tell you that. So
yes, I'm very worried about that.
Yeah, so, hey, Boyd, we will see you next week at Thriller Fest. I tell everybody to go on BoydMorrison.com. You've got a lot of events. You're going to be in a lot of different cities signing your book, starting here on July 5th in Seattle before you head out to Thriller Fest, and then you're going across the country here to Washington, California, Illinois, Wisconsin, Texas, Colorado, Missouri, all your fans can have some kind of opportunity to be able to meet you, get the copy of the book, and you'll be out there. So thanks again so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, and I'm looking forward to seeing you next week.
Yeah, so we'll see you. You have a great day, and go enjoy yourself.
I will. All right, you too.
Bye. All right, bye. Again, everybody, that was Boyd Morrison, the author of The Vault. Book comes out on Tuesday. Go to boydmorrison.com. You can find a lot more information. Like I said, he's going to be all over the place signing his book. Hopefully you can be able to catch him where he's at. He's going to be busy through the month of July, a little bit into August, and then VoucherCon in September. So it was great to have Boyd on. So we're going to roll right over here to our next guest, who's a good friend of ours we've had on the show before, John Gilstrap, who is writing, or is not writing, but hopefully he's done writing with, because his latest book is called Threat Warning, and it is available. So I want to say, John, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Very well. It's hot and humid and awful in Washington, D.C., but other than that, I'm at least it's sunny.
That's great, because, you know, it's hot, not humid here in Southern California, so we'll be hearing that humidity next week. We're so enjoyed and we're so thrilled to be able to get that humidity back in our blood in New York. No, not really, by the sound of it. So how have you been? We haven't talked to you, I don't think, since VoucherCon. We had you on with Hostage Zero on the radio show last year. So now you got Threat Warning coming out. You know, how was the journey, you know, with this book?
Well, you know, I so love the Jonathan Gray series. That's what Threat Warning is, the third installment of this series with the Freelance Hostage Rescue Specialist. And the whole notion of Threat Warning, it's about homegrown terrorism, and it's just a place I hadn't gone before, and it's a very interesting book to write, and I think it came out well. I'm really proud of it.
So, seeing as how it's your third book here in the Jonathan Graves series, you know, kind of how's Jonathan, you know, kind of progressed from the first book now up through Threat Warning? You know, what kind of new things what kind of new stuff are you going to be throwing at him here in this book?
Well, in Threat Warning, Jonathan is a former Delta Force operator, and in this book, the family of one of his colleagues in the unit are kidnapped, and the focus of the book is Jonathan getting that family back, but in the process of getting them back, he also uncovers this really hardcore, I think, terrifying threat against the heart of the government. In terms of Jonathan's development as a character, it's interesting. I've actually done this consciously, where I'm taking a very long view on him. My concern, I'm hoping that this is a series that lasts for many, many books. So in my mind, Jonathan has a very long development arc ahead of him, and he's got a very long backstory behind him. But for any given moment in time, I can only reveal so much because they're action books, so there's not a lot of time for internal rumination. So most of the character development in my books actually happens with the complete character arcs happen with the hostages from as they grow, and Jonathan grows much more slowly, if that makes any sense.
Sure, yeah, because you kind of want to, because let's face it, the hostages are pretty much only in one book, where Jonathan is now in three, so his progression can be a little bit slower than the characters who you're only going to be able to meet in one book. They have to be a little bit quicker.
Right. And in fact, it's interesting. I've talked with my editor. I probably shouldn't say this yet, but I've talked to my editor.
Yeah, say it. Say it. We love it.
Inside information. To do a few novellas, like in between the books, you know, a novella between each of the books that would probably be a direct ebook kind of thing, but it would tell part of Jonathan's backstory, which would be kind of cool.
I'll tell you, I've been saying that since the popularity now of the ebooks come out. I've kind of asked almost every author, now that you have that ability when you're writing a series with one character, you can now bridge books together and write, you know, kind of like a little 75 or, you know, 50 to 75 page bridge novella that bridges, like you would be able to do maybe like No Mercy to Hostage Zero and then Hostage Zero to Threat Warning, that gives those people more of the background. You know, it might not give them the whole, you know, you're not going to give them a whole action thriller in 50 to 75 pages, but it's a bridge. It lets people know what they're doing, and there's a lot less gaps in their lives.
Exactly. And there's a in Jonathan's case in particular, there, I've made allusions through all the books to a very troubled past. You know, that he comes from, his father was a criminal, and fans know that. But there are elements of his past, like I said, that I know, and there's just no place for it in the books. And I hope that the fans will want to know it. You know, that's the danger of doing this, and the part that actually concerns me about doing this is too much exposure. You know, sometimes the suspense, not knowing is better than knowing from the perspective of the reader. So, you know, what I don't want to do is do a backstory book and have the reader say, "Oh, really? That's it? That's why he's like this."
And Jonathan Grave, you know, this is kind of the first time that you've really done this type of series going forward. How much different is it than, you know, writing just a straight standalone where kind of the, you know, the hero kind of is there and gone in one book? What's the challenge has been for you in writing more of this series?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's I've never done a series before, as you say, and this is the first character I've developed that I feel has those kinds of legs. But truthfully, since I cut my teeth, my first four novels were standalone, and I did a nonfiction book. I cut my teeth in the standalone. So I sort of take that same approach to the series, where obviously there's some fan service. You don't want to do too much of the backstory stuff. But I kind of look at them as standalone books that have recurring characters. You know what I mean? And there's a gradual arc between reading the first book, and I'm now working on the fourth book that I have to deliver in September. If you read the whole thing together, you will see development in the character. But I always have to, I'm very cognizant of the fact that the first book that anybody reads in the series will be the book that's coming out now. So, you know, it's got to survive as a standalone. So there's a very long way of getting to the answer. I don't see a whole lot of difference other than the fact that I have the luxury of not having, it's a little simpler. I know the characters better. But in terms of character development with any given book, I have to understand, and I'm very cognizant of the fact that many readers haven't read the previous books.
Yeah, you kind of have to give a little bit of background, especially now with the series, because, you know, people might not know, you know, how he got to this point.
Right.
So, yeah. Right. So that's the thing.
And therein lies the biggest challenge is how do you let that information out and not bore the readers who've been with me for the entire journey, you know, like, okay, we already know that. So that's the balancing act. That and remembering the details, sort of the throwaway details of hair color and eye color and what kind of car they drive and that kind of stuff that just kind of you spew out as you're writing it. And then you realize, oh, no, I got to go back and make sure that it's the same thing.
Do you ever get caught by one of your readers and you're like, wait a second, I thought they had a green car. How did they get this red one?
Yeah, readers are very, very attentive people, and I love them for that. My most egregious error, and I'll just come forward with it, in Hostage Zero, there's a character who is a Marine Corps medic. And you know, I'm a Navy brat. My dad was a career Navy guy, and I know that there's no such thing as a Marine Corps medic. There are Navy corpsmen who are attached to the Marine Corps. And I don't know why I didn't. I knew better. It went out there. It went through all of the proofing and the editors. And there are a lot of Marines who read my work, and every single one of them has reminded me that there's no such thing as a Marine Corps medic. So my apologies.
So yeah, well, I'll tell you, you know, the editors and people like that, they might not know the ins and outs of the military and things like that, so they might have just said, hey, John said it, it's probably true, and they probably didn't even hit them to the fact that that might not or not be a true profession that would be in the Marines, so that's funny.
Yeah.
And you do, and you know, and you just mentioned something that is extremely interesting, is you just said that your fourth book has to be to them in September, but you know, Threat Warning just came out June 28th, and I want to remind everybody, we're talking with John Gilstrap here. You can find him at johngilstrap.com. His latest book is Threat Warning. You can find it everywhere. It came out June 28th. But now book four is all of a sudden due in September. Does that mean we don't have to wait, 12 months for another one? We're going to be able to get it in 6 to 9 months? Or is this just like the first draft and this is the process that you have to go through?
Well, this is the process. My books are due in September and they come out in July. So
okay. There
will be that allows for a fairly leisurely and detailed editing cycle. But typically, I see a book for the last time probably in December or January, and by then I'm well into the next book. And then you got all the marketing stuff and all the publishing stuff that I don't frankly understand that gets built into it. So it's always a year delay, or more or less 9 months delay from completion of a book to hitting the stand.
Now, do you ever, you just said this, so you have about 8 months where you don't see the book anymore and the book's gone. How many times when you wrote the book have you sat there and been like, and something happened, you're like, oh my God, I want to go back and change that because I just thought of a better way to write this scene or to do this, or you found something out that would be a lot more cool in order for you to put it in there. Has that happened?
No, actually, it's kind of a different twist on that same thing. By the time I actually read the book in the book form, and yes, I am vain enough to do that, after it comes out, and I read through it, I find it's like I've forgotten that I had written that. It's like, oh man, that was a really cool scene. I think there's real danger for any artist, whether they're a painter or a sculptor or a writer, to look in the rearview mirror too much. Once it's done, it's done. And I'll go back and read some of my earlier books, ones from 9, 10, 15 years ago, and I read them and I think, oh my God, it's just on and on and on. There are elements of the book that if I were to write it today would be entirely different. But I don't think from one book to the next real time, I don't think I have that problem there.
Yeah, and a lot of authors listen to our show, and I asked Boyd this question, and you've been writing a lot longer than Boyd has because this is his kind of first, The Vault was his first book that he ever wrote with a traditional publisher because the ARC he did self-publish. So since you've been with, and writing for a little longer than he has, how do you go about, because a lot of authors ask these questions to us, is how do you go about with, if you see negative reviews or negative publicity that comes out about your book, how did you handle it in the past and how has it changed for you now in the future if something like that happens?
Well, to be really honest, I've been very fortunate that way. I don't get most of my reviews are very positive. Hasa Zero got a star review in Publishers Weekly, and so by and large, the critics have been pretty good to me. You always get the one-offs on, the Citizen reviews, Amazon, and that sort of thing that
right.
Gilstrap doesn't know what he's doing and what have you. And those you just kind of brush off, not that I do know what I'm doing. It's just there's no value in there. But, it's through reviews and through fan letters and that sort of thing that you find out the mistakes you make, like this Marine Corps medic thing. I mean, that's all on me. I can't go back and change it. All I can do is apologize to it, and I hold these folks in such high regard. Those actually hurt me. They don't hurt my feelings. It's just I feel like I've really let these folks down, and that's bothersome. So what I do in those cases, you just retrench and you double and triple check the little details and hope that you get them all right. But other than that, I think you have to keep your head down and keep writing. And in my case, listen to my editors. So that's the best I can do. And but a negative review per se I much prefer to read positive reviews of my work. But what's there is there. The reality of this
right. Is,
as the author, I've had my shot. So what I think I've said is what I wanted it to say, and it's either going to resonate with readers or it's not. And that's. I can't influence that at that point. Since I can't influence it, I tend not to pay all that much attention.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting approach. If it gives you something of no value, then there's no point in dwelling on it because it's not going to be there to help or hurt. And I think a lot of authors, especially young authors today, when they put, when you're putting your work out there and you want to be noticed, you're going to be noticed positively and some people are going to notice you negatively, and you just have to kind of brush those things aside, and just move on and just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, and, you know, I participate in a number of online groups, and the question of critique groups always come up, especially for the new writer, the unpublished writer, whatever is the appropriate term. If nothing else, I've had the affirmation of 8 published books. So, you know, I'm a journeyman. I don't appeal to all tastes, but at least I am confident in my own abilities. Folks who are not confident and they get into a critique group, the problem is, who do you believe? If you really like your stuff and some other guy in the critique group doesn't, is he right or are you right? And what do you do with that information? I think some of these critique groups can be really damaging to people who are not secure in their own abilities.
And that's so true. And I know that you're also, and you're one of the one authors when we go to Thriller Fest and we get to listen and we get to listen to panels. You're one of the ones that you generally come across as, you know, being helpful, and because there's some that are just, I think, just kind of there to sell books, and they just, I'm not going to name names, but they just kind of come across like, I'm just doing this just so I can sell my book. But you generally come across as someone that, you know, you want to help, and that's what you're doing here, and you're going to be at Thriller Fest again this year. What panel do they have you on?
Actually, I'm going to be at Craft Fest, too. I'm doing on
Wednesday
afternoon. I'm doing a.
I always put the two together. I always mix them up.
I think there's a separate fee. I'm not sure, but anyway, I'm teaching a course called "Whose Story Are You Telling?" It's a course about point of view and how to be consistent to the point of view where you're discussing or where you're narrating. And then on Saturday, I'm on a panel that's the future of the military thriller. Which would be kind of interesting.
And maybe they're going to add Marine medics into that.
Yeah. I think the Marine Corps should change to accommodate me.
They should.
They're making me look bad.
They are. And so, yeah, I mean, so those are the things, because you write political thrillers, and they're a lot more, I mean, your books not only are political thrillers, but they're just fast, action-paced, you know, back and forth, of this and that, not a lot of downtime, which is good. And it takes a very, very much a different kind of author to keep that pace going. I mean, what do you do to keep that pace up? Because you know, a lot of authors like to have that downtime and throw in, you know, a lot of the romance or the comedy and things like that in there, but you just kind of keep it going, you know, throughout from beginning to end.
Well, thank you very much. To me, a thriller, that's what I write, are thrillers. Thrillers have an internal heartbeat, and as the story develops more and more, the heartbeat gets faster. And consequently, I become ruthless on anything that takes away from the action in the story. But I also want to say, this is, I hope you agree, I write very good characters as well. So I'm very strong on putting characters that I like, and I hope the reader likes, into these very difficult situations. But everything has to be true to solving the problem. And, in fact, I had somebody ask me the other day, how come there's kind of a romance between two of my characters, so, you know, why don't they ever do the dirty deed? And I said, when are they going to do this? We got people shooting at them, they're running, they're doing, they're rescuing kidnapped victims. Oh, I know, let's go. You know, go to bed. I mean, just, it doesn't
right.
fit into the story. So, but for me, it's all about being ruthless.
Some of those movies, though, and some movies and those kinds of things, they do. And all of a sudden, you're like, really, you're doing it right now? I mean, what's the point of that?
Yeah, and actually, one of the most egregious examples of that was written by a very good friend of mine, Jim Grady, and he wrote the book 6 Days of the Condor that became 3 Days of the Condor. So, you know, there's that scene, what is it, 1972 movie? There's a scene where Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway, he's kidnapped her, they're all that. So what do? They have sex.
Yeah,
it
why
just
not?
Felt like it was jammed into the movie.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's the biggest thing. And speaking of movies, how are we going to see, you know, now that you're writing a series and movie theaters and Hollywood start to like series more with characters, has there been any talk of Jonathan Graves coming to either the big screen or maybe the small screen in TV? Is there anything like that going on?
You know, there have been some sniffing around. A few agents, or my agent has shifted off to a couple of producers, but nothing nothing has come of that. And, you know, I am the mayor of development hell. I've sold four of my books to the movies, or sold or optioned four of them, and none of them have ever been made. I don't have good luck in the Hollywood side of things.
So you're pretty much...
However, I'm willing. You know, if there's a movie producer out there listening, call me.
Willing to get it done, and that's the way it should be. Hey, let's just, you know... I don't see why not. I see a lot of things in Hollywood right now that are, you know, have no purpose being where they're at. So that's why I always wonder why don't, you know, great characters, you know, in books like you write, you know, end up making it to the big screen. So I just always wonder that.
Well, I think, you know, history proves, I mean, the last few years, the kind of thriller that I write, which, like The Lincoln Lawyer, which was a wonderful movie, didn't do very well. Matthew McConaughey from the Michael Connelly
right.
book, and it had everything all stacked up. It didn't perform that well at the box office. And then, meanwhile, the comic book movies do. So, you know, it's the studios reward what works, and they turn away from what doesn't. Can't blame them for that.
Hey, I mean, you know, us dorks love our comic books. We just do.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with comic books.
I'm
not sure that they all come off very well.
No, they
on
don't.
The screen.
They don't.
Paging Joel Schumacher and Batman. So
yeah, we don't have to go there. You screwed it up. We don't have to. Okay, yeah, Arnold Schwarzenegger and, you know, Mr. Freeze was more of a comedy than anything else, which I felt was really bad. So. We're talking about, and a lot of people might not know this too, and I'm just going to, and you know, you dropped the bomb on the Marine medic, and I just have to drop the bomb and say that, you know, when we met you at BoucherCon again, we saw you there. You have a phenomenal way of replicating, you know, John Travolta and Saturday Night Fever. Want to know if that's going to happen again in Thrillerfest, if we can expect you and Shane Yerke to kind of bring that magic back together again.
I'm so glad this is radio.
I had to do
it. I'm not sure what
you're
implying here, John.
I'm just saying, you guys out in front of the hotel in San Francisco, you know, doing your best John Travolta and, you know, doing your best John Travolta. I can't really think of the word now. But, I mean, it was hilarious. It was great. I just want to know if we're going to see an encore of the disco come back in the 70s.
We all hope not.
Probably not.
I mean, secretly. Yeah. Secretly, we all hope that doesn't happen. But I appreciate you sharing it with people who didn't see it, so.
Well, you know, they have to kind of get the picture in their head. I mean, you know, we were there to get the picture in their head.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good. And so, coming back, and I just had to throw that in, and I didn't want to forget. And I want to remind everybody that we're, just in case, we're talking with John Gilstrap. You can't find the Saturday Night Live soundtrack here on his website at johngilstrap.com, but you can find out about Threat Warning, which is the third book here in the Jonathan Graves series. And like I asked Boyd, and I want to ask you, because you wrote Standalones back with Nathan's Run was your first book, and then you hit At All Costs, Up to Even Steven, and then Scott Free. Which one of those four, if you decide to take a break now from Jonathan Graves, which we know there's going to be book four because it's due in September, which one would you want to go back and maybe revisit and maybe pull the character out and maybe try another series with one of them? Or can you bring one of those characters back for one of those four books in a Jonathan Graves story? Is that at all possible?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that, because I just re-released in May At All Costs as an e-book. It'll come out as a P-book. That's actually a term now. Next
P-book
year.
P-book is a term?
Yes, as opposed to e-book, paper.
Oh, okay.
E-book. So, but there's a recurring character, a major character in the Graves series is the director of the FBI, who's named Irene Rivers. Well, Irene Rivers was a very important character in At All Costs, but she was a mere FBI agent at the time.
Right.
There's a character named Harvey Rodriguez in Hostage Zero, who had some trouble with the law, and he was prosecuted by a fellow named J. Daniel Petrelli, who is the same prosecutor who prosecuted Nathan in Nathan's Run. So there's DNA that's shared in almost all of the books. And in fact, Nathan's Run is coming out again. We're re-releasing that next month in August, again as an ebook with the paper book to follow in a year. So, you know, I've already done that. The cross-pollination thing is kind of fun. And it's also, I think, it's good for fans who are really paying attention to see this stuff. So it's I enjoy that.
Right. It's kind of a way to, kind of web and weave all your characters that you've created here in your 7-8 books to kind of bring them, bring them all together into one, big giant community, maybe like an epic kind of thing, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, it would be kind of cool, wouldn't it? I've always thought, for example...
It would take a lot of time and preparation, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I'm not sure I'd want to do it with mine, but I've always toyed with the idea... I don't think you can legally do this because of copyright stuff, but I want to have all of the John Grisham characters who have run off to the Cayman Islands to join together.
Exactly.
And then they can solve crimes together on the Caymans.
I think that they should. I think that they should all do that and, go off to... Because, they all seem to run to the Caymans, and in fact, Grisham is kind of one of those authors that, just likes to put people in the Cayman Islands.
Well, it's a way to, there's a great tax write-off for the research trips, so.
Exactly. Well, John, I will tell you, we've kind of run out of time here. We've been going 25 minutes. It's been amazing, and
I love it.
So I want to remind everybody, Threat Warning, the latest book, came out June 28th. It's available wherever books are sold. Third book here in your character series, Jonathan Graves. Your website, johngilstrap.com. Are you going to be going out and doing any events? And I know that that's on your website. People can find that out, and they can meet you. Are you doing any book signings?
There's going to be a big book signing in Reston, Virginia, on July 16th from 3 to 5 p.m. That's really the only book signing per se. I'm going to be at the Harriet Austin Writers Conference in Athens, Georgia, the third week, the 22nd of July. But other than that, no, I'm just humping along in the next book.
Fabulous. That's great. Well, I'll tell you, John, it's always a pleasure. I want to thank you so much. We're going to see you in a week in Thriller Fest, and we're looking forward to it. So thanks a lot much for coming on with us.
It's been my pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk to you again, John.
All right. You have a good day, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Happy 4th.
Yeah, happy 4th. Have a good one, and stay out of the humidity.
I'll do my best. You take care.
Come to L.A., man. Come to L.A. It's just hot here. There's no humidity. You know you want to, so come on.
I just spent 16 hours at LAX. I'm okay. I've had my L.A. fix.
Because that counts. All right. Have a good one, John.
We'll see you.
All right, bye. So, again, everybody, that was John Gilstrap, best-selling author of Threat Warning. His book is out June 28th, third book in his series of Jonathan Graves. You can find out more information by going to johngilstrap.com. Great books. Earlier we had Boyd Morrison on, best-selling author of The Ark, and his latest book, The Vault, which comes out on Tuesday. So we are moving right along here, taking no breaks, and we are going to jump right into our next guest, which is just brought out her first fiction book, Guilt by Association. You probably know her from the 95, of course, O.J. Simpson trial, and Marcia Clark. So, Marcia, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and how are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing great.
Great. It's such a pleasure to be able to get to talk with you. I know that you were gone last weekend. You had Poison Pen, and we couldn't hook up with it. It's great to be able to bring you back today because we're so excited to see Guilt by Association. We love legal thrillers, and especially when, lawyers are writing them and not just people thinking that they know the law. And So it was great. So can you tell us a little bit about your latest character, Rachel Knight, DA, from Los Angeles, which is where we're from. So, what I really loved was on your website, Marcia Clark Books, is you can actually go visit the places that she's visiting. So you're making it a really big scene with the characters, which is something that a lot of people do not do.
I thought that L.A. should be a character because it so figures into the life of a lawyer who's practicing in downtown L.A., especially a prosecutor who's practicing, in the special trials unit in downtown Los Angeles. all of the scenes that are around the court building, the life that you live working downtown, and especially in that particular unit, which is so all-consuming, you live there. You know, even if you don't live there, your house is not there,
right.
You kind of live there. And so I thought, wow, it really was a character for me. I want to make it as real as possible, which is kind of like, it had a lot to do with my motivation in writing. I always wanted to write fiction since sometimes as a little kid. I just had no confidence that I could make a living at it. So I thought, if I want to live indoors,
a lot of
I have
authors
to find
don't
something.
Have that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, I like indoor plumbing, so I'm going to go find something else to do. So
right.
I just came back to it at this point in my life and thought, now or never. And what I wanted to do was recreate the world that I had lived in, that I loved so much being a prosecutor. It's a wonderful job. And especially the job of a special trials prosecutor, which is a unique thing that I thought, you know, you haven't seen other, I don't know whether other jurisdictions have something like this. But, sorry. In Los Angeles County, there was a special trials unit, which was a very small unit made up of, at that time, 5 or 6 lawyers who handle all the high-profile complex cases. And so you only handle these marathon cases from around the county. It didn't matter where they were. We would handle them. It meant that we got to do a lot of investigation because we would pick up those cases from the day the body was found and actually work with the detectives out there doing the investigation, talking to witnesses, putting the case together, often spent more time in the investigation than we did in trial. So I wanted to be able to show that kind of unique prosecutorial life because most prosecutors don't even see their case file till they're on their way to court to pick a jury. So in that life, there is a lot of investigation and field work involved and a lot of involvement with the police. And I thought that would be fun to show, and it would be fun to relive that time that was so wonderful. So it's kind of the ability for me to relive it, to share it with you, and to show you the fun as well as the excitement and the satisfaction of doing a job like that.
You know, and almost being a prosecutor is almost like a thankless job because if you lose, it's all your fault, and if you win, well, you were supposed to win. So... you kind of bring that out in your character, Rachel Knight, here in your book, Guilt by Association. How difficult was it for you to bring that emotion that you've had because, you know, you've won and lost cases as a prosecutor in Los Angeles, and to be able to bring that emotion and that realism to your character, Rachel Knight?
Yeah, you know, it is true. If you win, it was a no-brainer, and if you lose, you're an idiot. Yes.
Yep.
And I mean, in that respect, there's an awful lot of pressure, but... you know, the authenticity is something that I think is really important. I think readers can tell when a writer really knows the world they're talking about. And I think that's where having lived it for so many years, it's so helpful. In the course of being a prosecutor, the other really helpful thing was that because these cases were so complicated, there was all kinds of different evidence involved. And I had to make it a point to study every single kind of evidence, every forensic field that was involved in my case. So I got to learn about all kinds of blood work, all kinds of blood spatter evidence, all kinds of fingerprints, how they can be manufactured, how they can be lifted out, all kinds of horrible things that can happen to evidence in order to explain to a jury why it didn't happen here. Tool marks, firearms, everything, you name it. I got a chance to learn it. And so it makes it a lot easier to deliver a story because I've learned all of this stuff already, having done it, and I can incorporate it more easily and with more reality, more truth to it. So as far as the emotions of being a prosecutor, right, that comes in too, you know, the pressure of it, the ups and the downs of it. It is definitely like that when you're putting a case together and when you're in trial. Every day brings something that is unexpected, you can't predict. From day to day what's going to happen. And that's part of the thrill of the job as well as the terror of the job.
Yeah. And doesn't it make it that much more fun when you're writing a book like you did here in Guilt by Association that you're able to use, because when you watch court TV, let's face it, that is so extremely boring of what exactly happens in a trial that when you're watching Law and Order, you're like, yeah, that's the way I want it to go because it's real fast-paced. Isn't it great to be able to use your imagination and take the boring stuff out and only ask the really interesting questions and really bring the great courtroom drama, here and the outside part of this outside the courtroom because that's what Rachel does.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's so true. The part that I get to skim over, I make reference to it in the book so that the reader knows, you know, I'm not completely ignoring reality. So I'll mention that Rachel Knight looks at the stack of motions she has to get through and the work that she has to do, and then sits down and plows through and spends hours doing it to get a little bit of clear space on her desk. So that's about as far as I go, because who wants to watch that? Who wants to see it? That's the kind of stuff that you get to skim over and go straight for the fun part. Also, you know, I mean, I set up a case for myself, and then I wind up setting up a case where there's absolutely no way to solve it, you know, the dead body in the locked room kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
So I can always go back and say, wait, I need more evidence.
Right.
Backspace.
Yeah, you can go back and just maybe, yeah, you're back, I'm just going to make this just happen.
Yes, I found a witness. Duh. But the one thing I don't ever want to do, and I hope I avoid, is the too convenient witness that pops up at the very moment you need them. You know, I want to show that it's hard work. Investigation is hard, plodding, unexciting work in general, so I can't let it be that in the book. But what I can show is that the characters work very hard to get to the clues and the ideas and the epiphanies that they reach that help to solve a case. It doesn't just fall in their lap. And when they do find a witness, it's because they've been looking really hard for that witness. It doesn't just, whee, look what happened here, you know.
Right.
And I want to make sure I always have them earn whatever they get.
Well, now that you're no longer practicing law, but I do know that you were on True TV. Oh, okay. So you still, but you're no longer a prosecutor?
No, right.
Okay. So, and I know that you were on True TV and you talked about the Casey Anthony case that's going on right now. But now that you're kind of becoming more of an author, and hopefully that this is what you decide that you're going to go with, you know, going forward, is which did you find more of the challenging part? Because when you're prosecuting a case and you're going after and you have to sift through all these things and all these little intricate details, but then in a book, you have to do the same thing because, like John Gilstrap just said, the readers will find out and they will pick it up, and then you're going to start getting emails saying, you can't do this because this doesn't happen and this and that. Mm-hmm. Which did you find more challenging?
You know, they're each challenging in their own ways, and John is so right about that. You can't mess around. You have to get it right. I mean, obviously, I'm going to consult with people when I need to, and of course, I always take the author's the only fair position to take. All mistakes are mine. So whoever I consulted with, I apologize if I got it wrong. And we try to get it right. So there is a lot of work. There's a lot of effort. There's a lot of effort. The research is less challenging to me than it is to put together a story that is complex enough, but true enough, real enough, that, of course we have to strain the bounds of reality to make it fun, because it's not a story worth writing unless man bites dog, right? But you still have to give it a feeling of reality and authenticity so that the reader isn't pulled out of the moment by going, what? You never want that to happen. That requires a lot of work, a lot of thought, a lot of preparation. I'm one of those who I like to outline. I like to see where my story's going so I can think about where the holes are, what doesn't work. But delivering a story that is fun to read, exciting enough, but also real enough, is a real challenge. And, it is its own set of challenges that's different than prosecuting.
And so how long did it take you to kind of develop the Rachel Knight character, and how many drafts did you have to go through and realize, hey, this isn't going, this isn't working, before you finally were able to hit that home run mark that you said, I finally got it, and this is where it's at?
Oh, my God, so many that I have to tell you, if I'd known probably in the beginning how hard it was going to be to get to a book that was worth reading, I think I might not have done it. But I wanted to do it so badly, I just didn't think about it. I put my head down and just went full speed ahead. And I started this way back, actually, the idea of really writing started in 2002 when I got to consult on a one-hour legal drama for Lifetime called For the People, and started writing scripts then. And after that, I went out with the creator of that show and wrote pilots. We're now writing another pilot for Lifetime. So it started then. I didn't start to write a book until 2006, but at that point, it was tough because I was also handling criminal appeals full time. So I would literally work all day and then write all night for years. 2006, I started my first efforts to put together a novel and with Rachel Knight. And there were so many drafts and so many efforts. At first she was too harsh, then she was too soft, then she was, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, it took forever until finally, I think it was in 2009, towards the end of 2009, I said, you know what, I get it. I know what to do. And I sat down and actually did it. And, of course, that you know there were several drafts of that even to make it readable and worth sending out to anybody to see. So, boy, it was a long row. Long road. Yeah.
And so were you contacted to write something like this, or did you just start doing it on your own and you said, then when it's done, I'm going to start sending it out to people and hopefully that they like it? And that had to be extreme nervousness and anxiety to wonder, all right, I'm putting myself out here in something I've never done before, and if they hate it, it just could be devastating.
Yeah,
I don't know, I don't want to go over here with that.
Yeah, you know what? You couldn't have put it better. It's like you were in my head. Oh, my God. When I finally did, you know, I finally came to the point where I thought I had something. But let me think. Let me dial back. In the very beginning, I got kicked in the stomach a bunch of times. Nobody asked me to do this. I was not made an offer. Oh, please write us this book. We can't wait to see the, you know, the dulcet pear-shaped tones that find their way onto the page from you. No one wanted that. No one asked me for that. I started writing, and at first I wrote a few chapters and then an outline of the remaining story, sent it to an agent who said, what? And I said, okay, never mind.
God.
Yeah, exactly. I remember hunched over my computer feeling like I was just, you know, I felt like someone had smashed me in the face with a shovel. And then she said, you know what, but let me send this to my reader, see what he thinks of it. I said, don't bother, I get it, I can't do this. Well, unbeknownst to me, she sent it to her reader anyway, and 2 or 3 weeks later I got, she forwarded his report, which said, actually the writing is very good. Tell her to do a standard murder mystery and go from there and see, you know. So the knowledge that a professional reader might say she can do this kind of pumped me up. And I said, okay, I'm going to take another shot at this. So I threw that story out because it was kind of a character study of crime victims that was very much apart from the prosecutor. I put the prosecutor way in the background. And the story was really all about the girls who were the victims. And he was saying, you know, go for the gusto where people really want to see you write, and try it again. So I did. I threw that out. I went for a whole new story, wrote that book, and worked on that one for 2 or 3 drafts, and then showed it to the creator of the show, who said, "Who is this character? Who is this prosecutor? Rachel Knight doesn't sound like anything I'd ever want to see in court. She's a cream puff. She strikes me as somebody who wears a pinafore. Go back again and write somebody real." So then I did that.
Oh, my God.
Exactly. I did that, and then that book actually got some interest from an agent who said, take notes from my team. I took notes from the team for about a year, at the end of which they fired me.
Wow.
Said, this book is not getting there. This book is not getting there. So, you know, but we think that, you know, you should keep trying. You can really write, but this is not going to make it. So at that point, though, I'd had enough experience to know that I knew the book hadn't been working. I was ready to throw it out, and I said, I'm throwing it out. I'm going to start all over. And they said, no, don't do that. Just go pay an editor. I said, no, that's not what I need. I need a story that works. And at that point, I finally knew. But at that point, I'm sitting down to write a book after 2 agents have basically told me, yeah, you know. And every
You're
single,
lucky it was only 2. A lot of
yeah,
authors,
you know,
like
that
20.
Was the luck of it. Yeah. It could have been so many more, right? I know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it would have been so many more, except I didn't have the guts to send it out to anybody else.
Yeah.
Because the minute I heard it wasn't, I have to say, after the second agent said, you know, this isn't working, I thought, I know it isn't working, and I bet I know why. And so I threw out the story. The story did not work. And so, but at that point, I was handling such a heavy caseload that I was literally working day and night 24/7. I would hear people outside in the summertime playing and think, someday I'm going to get to go outside.
Someday.
There was no time. And at the same time, so gut-wrenchingly nervous, scared, like almost stomach-turningly so, that no one's ever going to want to read this. No one's ever going to think it's going to be worth anything. You know, and what if nobody ever likes it? And that'll be the end of my whole dream of writing. And every single day I went through some version of that kind of anxiety until I got, you know, the good news that actually people were interested, and that was guilt by association.
So that, I mean, I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with Marcia Clark and the author here right now, national bestseller, Guilt by Association, is out now. You can find out more information by going to MarciaClarkBooks.com. Read all about Rachel Knight, the books that come, you know, the book that's coming out. You can find anywhere you want to. So that's the long journey that you took. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, when they're readers, and it's almost like movies, that sometimes these things are 5-6 years into the making. And you're talking, you know, 2002, starting out saying you want to do it, and then finally 2006 coming down. But, I mean, that's a long journey. And now the pressure's really on because you don't have that much time for your next book, which you probably have to write now. You know, they want it, like, within a year that your next book's going to come out.
Oh, sooner than that, it's actually done. The second book, I've just turned it in to be, it's going to the publisher on Tuesday. For notes, but basically I think it's, you know, pretty close. And, yeah, there was no time at all. You turn in the book, and then they turn around and say, okay, now next one, next. And
yeah,
it's got to come out in April of 2012. So there's really not a lot of time to hang out by the pool in your floaties.
No, not even today when it's going to be 105 degrees at my house over here in the valley. It's
yep,
you know, it's going to be tremendously hot, which – we don't like that in Southern California. People might think, oh, that's, you know, there's no humidity. Still flipping hot.
Exactly.
Hot.
Still an oven.
Yeah. So now,
yeah, that's why
how
I love
many
when
books
say that.
How many books are we going to be, you know, can we have here with Rachel Knight? I don't know how many you were signed up for at the beginning. Two, maybe three, maybe more. So we have at least two, and you're going to go beyond. So what can we expect coming from Rachel Knight? Or are you planning on saying, okay, I'm going to do a couple with her, and then I'm going to do maybe a standalone, but you're going to stick with legal thrillers? Is that your intention?
Yeah, I love crime fiction. I've loved crime fiction for like 100 years. And, I mean, even when I was a prosecutor, I'd go home and watch Law & Order. I'd read murder mysteries, James Ellroy. You know, I mean, I'm just addicted. So I'm not going to veer into the supernatural. I can pretty much promise you vampires are not in my future.
Yes.
And I think it'll always be crime fiction. I want to write Rachel Knight stories for quite a while. I'm not looking at any standalones at this point. I think there's so much to explore with her and her friends. This is a story of her and her best friend, Detective Bailey Keller of Robbery Homicide Division, and her the special trials prosecutor, Tony LaColette. There's a lot to talk about with those three women, so I'm kind of stick with that for quite some time, I think.
And you have some events you're coming up. You're not going to be at Thriller Fest coming next week. And I don't know if you're a member of the ITW or not, but you're going to be coming up here. You are?
Yeah, I'm a member, but I'm not going
okay,
up
Okay, great.
Because,
yeah, because right. It's a great thing. And hopefully, and you know, I would have loved to be able to meet you at Thriller Fest because it's a great thing to go to. But, of course, I know you're busy. But you are going to be at a Book Passage Mystery Writers Conference here July 22nd and 23rd. So can you kind of explain how has that process been? Because you were never able, you know, as a prosecutor, you know, you didn't really have to go and sell yourself, but now you have to go out and do events, and you're doing radio shows and things like that about your work, not about your past experiences, but now about the stuff that you've created on your own. How difficult was it for you to have to do that?
Oh, man. It's so funny. Boy, your questions really hit the sweet spot, I got to tell you. You're so right on.
I spend a lot of time with these
so
questions, I'm telling
you. Yeah, oh, my God. You're making me relive all these really, I mean, like, nausea-inducing moments of my life. And
that's the
that
whole
is,
idea.
It's so much harder. It's so much harder.
Yeah.
It's one thing. I mean, I even did the lecture circuit after the trial and talked about, you know, domestic violence and all that stuff. And, you know, so you're just talking to people about stuff that you know. That's not selling yourself. You know, it's this, oh, my God, it's so much harder. It's scary. You know, I mean, this is something I've created. It's like my baby, and you're holding your baby out to the world saying, do you think she's cute? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, and people will say, no, I really don't. I think she looks like a Martian. So you never know how people are going to respond.
They'll get you in the book industry. They won't play in the book industry. They'll tell you whether or not they like it or not. That's one thing that they will not do. They won't sugarcoat it for you.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and I feel, like, incredibly lucky that, you know, to have gotten the reviews that I've gotten. I was like, wow, thank God. And each one of them, you know, came down. I was, relief was so palpable. I actually sank into my chair and splayed out my feet. Oh, thank God.
Well, that was one of the questions we asked you, because we sent over the magazine, the July issue. We sent it over to your publicist and over to your publisher, and hopefully they'll forward it on to you, because we don't have your personal email address. So hopefully you'll see that. But that was one of the questions we asked you in the interview that's in the July issue is, you know, waiting for a jury verdict is very much nerve-wracking, and now you're having to wait for reviews on your first book is very much nerve-wracking.
Yep.
And it was like, were they kind of the same thing? And you just kind of answered that. Yeah.
Yeah, and they kind of are. You know, I mean, they really are. It's like everything's at stake here. Of course, you know, jury verdicts are very much more serious in terms of the tragedy of that the cases are, and the final issue as to whether or not a guilty person is brought to justice. So, you know, I mean, it's much more serious. But in terms of the kinds of emotions you can have, there's a similarity there, no question.
Yeah, and we would love to hear your thoughts of when you see the interview. You can always, when you see it, you can always email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com when you see it, because we'd love to hear your thoughts, and we kind of post them from the authors that we are able, you know, that we interview and whatnot. So the other thing, too, last question, because, you know, since your debut fiction, even though, you know, you've been, you're still a celebrity personality, what was the myth that dispelled for you when you got into publishing that you thought was true, but then all of a sudden once you got into it, you were like, oh, this is not exactly at all what I thought it was going to be like?
In terms of the business of publishing?
In terms of the business of the side of it, because we have a lot of authors that listen to the show and ask us questions, and they are so off on the fact, they're like, hey, I just got a book sold. Now I don't have to do anything. No, baby. No.
Yeah. Oh, that's so true. Now, I happen to have already known this because of the trial book that I wrote a million years ago.
Right.
About the Simpson trial. So I knew that there was more, so much more than writing the book. And that is the touring and the selling of it. It's so much more, it's more than you think it will be, especially because there's such a thing as satellite tours and stuff like that. But no, they send you around, and if you're lucky, you know, if you're lucky, and I'm so grateful. But it is exhausting. It's exhausting, and it's also very stressful, because every time you do an appearance, you know, there's fear about how people are going to react and how they're going to respond and who likes your book and who doesn't, who shows up and who doesn't. So it's a stressful time. But as I think an established author once said, the only thing worse than touring is not touring, you know. And it's the gift of all time to be able to have the ability to get out there in the world and have the publisher send you around to sell the book. As stressful as it is, there's no other way to do it, and it's a lot of work. And then, of course, you have to go back and start writing book two, and the experience of being out there selling the book versus writing a book they require such different mindsets that it takes a while to, like, gear down, power down, and get into your head again to start writing, so it gets a little crazy, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, Marcia, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I want to thank you for bringing out Guilt by Association, and we look so forward to your next book, and hopefully, you know, your publicist will send us the copies when it's coming out. And I don't know, are you on for the next year? Are you going to be 9 months? Do you know when they're tentatively going to bring your next book out?
Yeah, they tell me it's going to be in April.
Okay, good. That's
and
a good month.
Right, the same month, and it's going to be titled Guilt by Degrees.
Okay.
And yeah, and I'm very, very sure they're going to send you advanced copies. I have no doubt. I'll be back if you'll have me back. This was a pleasure.
Absolutely.
It's just delightful.
Yeah, let's stay in touch, and you know, we might see you if you decide to go to BoucherCon and Thriller Fest and things like that to go out there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, get more with the people. We will see you out there. So we want to thank you so much for coming on.
Right, I'll see you at BoucherCon. That sounds wonderful.
And congratulations on the book. And I mean, you've done an outstanding job, because it's not an easy thing to do, even though you're writing about a subject that you know, it's still extremely difficult to do, and you did it wonderfully. So kudos to you. Even if it took you 5 years or so to get it done, you got it done, and you did it the right way, and that's the important part.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. I hope we get to do this again soon.
Absolutely. So thank you, Marcia. You have a great day, and enjoy the 105 degrees outside.
Thank you. I'm going to go get my floaties.
Exactly. Now you can, because your book is in the hands of the publisher. So they're not going to mess with you at least until after the holidays. So that's good. You got 3 days off.
Yeah, wee!
Yeah.
You try to stay cool.
All right, have a good one, Marcia, and enjoy yourself.
All right, you too.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that was Marcia Clark. Her latest book, Guilt by Association, with her character, D.A. Rachel Knight. It's an outstanding legal thriller read. Everyone needs to go get it. You can go find it at MarciaClarkBooks.com for more information. It's available wherever books are sold. And like she said, I mean, this is again, someone who knows about the subject, who's able to put in the real-life emotion into the character and into the subject matter that really makes it the realism part, along with being just a tremendous thriller that she's been able to weave. And that's just the great part about it. So we've had an outstanding show today. I want to thank everyone for listening. We had Boyd Morrison on first. Seems like it's been on a while ago, and it was just not too long ago. You know, this is our biggest show yet, coming up for the holiday weekend as we're cutting into Thriller Fest. So we have Boyd Morrison. His book, The Pulse, comes out on Tuesday. You can find out information about him on BoydMorrison.com. You can also go, and John Gilstrap was on earlier, and you can find that information at JohnGilstrap.com, and his book was Threat Warning. And then we just had Marcia Clark with Guilt by Association, and her book, as you can be found at MarciaClarkBooks.com. So it's been an outstanding day. I want to thank everybody for joining us. We are off at Thriller Fest. If you see us, say hello. We love to talk to everybody. SuspenseMagazine.com is our website. You can find out all the information there. Cross your fingers. Suspense Radio might have a huge announcement coming up after Thriller Fest. We'll wait and see. I'm not going to say anything, but you could be hearing us in a lot more different locations. So again, get your 4 free issues. July issue is out now. We love you all. Thank you so much for joining us. We will be back here on the 16th of July. We will not have a show next week because we will be gone. 16th of July, you can check out our schedule by going to suspensemagazine.com, click on the radio button, and we will see you all then. Thanks a lot, everybody.